This episode of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 30th of December 2012 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Weekly is brought to you in association with Tourism Australia.
Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly, episode 182, with me, Aisha Spears, and Barrett Austin.
On the show today, we'll be talking to a filmmaker whose new documentary, Breaking the Taboo, looks at the war on drugs and asks if it's time to wave the white flag. Cosmo Fielding Mellon will be joining us here in the studio.
We'll also hear from journalist and author Colin Brown to learn what it means today to be British. My co-presenter Barrett will be ready and taking notes.
And we'll be speaking with Manisha Rajesh about the lost art of train travel and why hopping a train in India is well worth savoring.
All that plus a huge straw goat from Sweden, Tom Edwards with the first news look ahead of 2013, and some music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. We're a day before New Year's Eve, Barrett. How was your Christmas?
I had a lovely Christmas in Alabama with my family, a couple of good meals, catching up with the family and seeing some old friends, and now we're here.
Are there any Alabaman Christmas traditions? I'm trying to think of what I would imagine that to be, but I don't know. Do you deep fry anything?
There was no deep frying going on in my household this year. I think a number of others were, though, because if you turn on the news, a lot of local news agencies are showing the risks of deep frying turkeys. So
not just the health risks.
Not the health risk. That's in Alabama. That's something people don't think about too much. It's more the risk of burning down your house in deep frying a turkey. So none of that around my house. We had a bit of turkey this year, which was wonderful.
And New Year's Eve is coming up, and looking forward to the new year. We're now going to take a little look closer into the next week, not the whole year, with Tom Edwards' news agenda. Tom Edwards, I feel like you need your own jingle for the news agenda.
I'd like to have that.
I think that'd be good.
Piece of signature music.
Could that be something that could happen the first week of 2013?
Let's get someone onto it.
So what else, apart from your own news jingle, will be happening in the first week of 2013?
Well, something that's happening today, and this is all about, you know, celebrating the new year. You mentioned the traditions that are in play. In Russia, the Russian Prime Minister, Dmitry Medvedev, he signed a decree granting Russians a 10-day New Year break.
That doesn't sound very Russian.
Pretty generous, I would
say.
But it would agree with me, 10 days. Why not? Signed back in October, 3 extended public holidays, New Year, May Day, and Victory Day. I must confess, I don't know exactly when a Victory Day is. But according to a survey, Russians prefer shorter winter holidays and longer holidays in the springtime.
So are some of them going to just refuse to take this 10-day holiday? You're not allowed to really protest, are you, in Russia?
It's generally frowned upon.
Are they just making sure that no one gets up to no good in the 10 days?
Well, it's interesting because apparently one of the reasons why winter breaks aren't so popular is because there's a lot of costly presents. That's one objection that's usually raised. And secondly, excessive alcohol consumption.
In Russia?
Who would have thought that? Whereas spring breaks can be more positive. For example, a good opportunity for some spring cleaning.
Or actually in the US, spring break is, I think, when most of the alcohol in the country gets consumed by crazy American university students.
Yeah, I believe you have to sort of shout spring break, don't you, in a particular
indeed.
Kind of frat house style.
It's something that I have no experience with whatsoever. I may have had a couple of great US spring breaks across the years, but I was always well behaved. I think I was just studying.
You must have been in the back of a pickup truck shouting spring break, and isn't it? What is
it? I think there may be a video on YouTube now, something along those lines. But I can assure you, while it may look like me, it's not.
Barrett Austin, colon, the disgrace.
Maybe you should get yourself over to Russia during the Christmas period. There's clearly a lot of alcohol to be drunk. And aside from Russia and their holidays,
I thought in honour of Barrett, and of course, you know, our New York bureau chief, I try and get some stories with a little bit of an American flavour. The first one, well, it's either kind of sad or just the inexorable progress of time, depending on your attitude. This is happening tomorrow. So on New Year's Eve, symbolically, Newsweek is printing its final edition. We've known about this for some time. Been a kind of symbolic year-ending, era-ending gesture after, I think it's about 80 years of publication, digital only. Boo hiss.
It's a weird one.
I wonder what do you make of it?
It's an interesting one because we've got Tina Brown obviously at the helm of Newsweek. Over the last year, there's been such controversy over their covers, over the Niall Ferguson piece, which got a lot of attention. And I think that it's a sad example of them focusing their office, the IAC building, excuse me, in New York, the Frank Gehry building, looking more at the Daily Beast as opposed to Newsweek. Are you going to be sad to see it go?
Well, I tell you what I'm sad about is I'm sad about some of the kind of the rhetoric you hear. So you mentioned Tina Brown there. I mean, she said, we're not saying goodbye. We're just transitioning Newsweek. Oh. And that kind of language I find, frankly.
So I wonder what that actually means, this sort of transition moving forward.
Goodness only knows.
We'll be seeing in the first week of 2013. One of my favourite useless words of 2012, just looking back a little bit, that has apparently passed newsroom floors, is something we heard from a new colleague of ours, the transport editor, who has said that many newsrooms use the word efforting. Efforting is a word in emails and both in emails and in person. The people, I'm efforting to get that done for you. How do you feel about that, Tom?
Nauseated.
Is it? Nauseating? Are you is it nauseating you?
Yeah, I feel nauseous.
I wonder what sort of things we're efforting in 2013 here at Monocle.
Just everything.
Oh, wait, I just used it here.
Across the board efforting from me, as always.
Are you going to effort to have a New Year's resolution?
Well, I don't like to promise too much.
You don't
I feel
effort
I
that.
Can deliver better if I don't promise anything.
Got it. Okay.
It's an interesting psychological game. One other thing I should mention tomorrow night, just for, you know, American economic watchers. I believe it's the kind of the actual cliff edge of the fiscal cliff at kind of midnight.
It is.
So when the bell chimes, I don't know what happens.
The
when
end
you
of the world.
Off the fiscal cliff. Is it like these Mayan prophecies? Yeah. I'm not quite sure.
We didn't die in the 21st of December, so it might be the end
we
of the fiscal.
We climb on, yeah. Just about.
I was going to say we survive the end of the world according to the Mayan. So I think the fiscal cliff, while serious, is something that hopefully we'll be able to get through.
But next to it's a bit terrifying. Prophecy. It's easy street.
Who do you trust more, the Mayans or John Boehner?
I'd probably lean towards the Mayans, to be honest.
Yeah, I'm with you.
I'm in the same boat. Yeah, I think it's right.
It's kind of traditional quality they've got going on there. Well, shall I move on?
Yeah, I think so.
What about New Year's Day itself? That's on Tuesday, of course. Got another US flavour to this one. Just easing across to the West Coast. A bit of California action. This struck my attention. It's pretty interesting. Californian legislative ban on the consumption of shark fin soup goes into effect on New Year's Day.
The Californians love to ban things. They banned foie gras and shark fin. So both of these very cruel ways of producing food. What's interesting with the shark fin soup thing is that there's a huge, huge Asian population in California. So I'm sure there'll be some quite brilliant underground black market shark fin soup. I mean, how do you smuggle shark fins? You need quite an interestingly shaped bag.
Deep pockets, perhaps.
Bowling bag. I'd go for bowling bag.
Nice, I see with the shape.
Yeah.
But shark fins apparently sell for around $600 a pound. Now, I wonder if this ban comes in, what's that going to do to the prices? Because as you say, I'm sure there'll be a black market.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think that sort of gives me an idea of what I might be doing in 2013. A new sort of job opportunity, perhaps doing a bit of smuggling on the West Coast.
Off the back of a pickup truck while on spring break.
Exactly.
What can I say? I'm raised a rogue man.
Anyone? one other thing that's also happening the same day in California, we're very busy legislatively, it'll be the first state to officially ban this phenomenon, gay therapy.
Oh, is that correcting homosexuality?
Which is to sort of correct this, you know.
I'm very glad they're banning that.
Very interesting. So it's kind of like, you know, shark fins, gay therapy,
and
very much on the agenda.
A leader in that industry is Michelle Bachmann's husband, who is a leader in correcting what he sees as a curse from God. So I'm glad that he won't be able to practice in California.
Better not be there that day.
If he is, let's hope he gets imprisoned.
He'll get run out of town. Yeah, or jailed. Even better.
Thank you very much for joining us, Tom. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly. And next up, we'll be talking with filmmaker Cosmo Fielding Mellon about his new film, Breaking the Taboo. Alongside the well-documented presidential election in the U.S. this November was the vote in the states of Washington and Colorado to legalize the regulated use of marijuana, an interesting step for the socially conservative United States to take. And we're left wondering, should other nations follow suit?
The root of considerable crime, corruption, and violence across the globe, the illegal drug trade is now the third most valuable commodity in the world. Documenting the history of the war on drugs from the 1960s to today, Breaking the Taboo is a film that advocates for the liberalization of drug policy around the world. The film's director, Cosmo Fielding Mellon, joins us in the studio. Cosmo, thank you for joining us. So tell me, why is there such a taboo around changing drug policies?
I think it's probably because they've become a moral issue, drugs. I think that's the problem. People are treating them morally rather than pragmatically. So people say, drugs are bad, we have to fight them, rather than drug user ill, we have to help them. And I think that's created this sense in the media and politics that make politicians scared to speak out, basically.
And why are they treated so differently from other regulated, I mean, drugs, nicotine, alcohol? How do we make them seen in the same way?
It's a gradual process, I suppose. I think people speaking out makes the difference, really.
And it seems that there's also this big credibility issue, because for so long in the US and elsewhere around the world, people are told if you use drugs, you're going to have a terrible life and you're likely to die. But in fact, most people that are using drugs seem to be happy in some cases, and many of them are not dead. And a lot of the people that are sort of coming forth with these agendas are people who probably haven't used drugs. What do you make of the credibility issue of anti-drug campaigns around the world?
The statistics, according to the UN, and they're very conservative, is that there are 230 million drug users in the world. And the UN classifies 90% of them as no problem, but we're arresting them all. So it's ridiculous. And exactly, those campaigns, I mean, they've got more sophisticated than they used to be. You know, the Just Say No things. It still doesn't work. People aren't allowed to be honest about drugs, which means the credibility is lost, really. I mean,
let's talk a little bit about the film. It took a global approach. When you were travelling around and meeting all sorts of different leaders and people working on drug policy, what nations really led the way for you? Or what leaders, in fact?
Fernando Cardoso, who's the head of the Global Commission on Drug Policy, really, I think, is a very important person in this subject, because the Global Commission was the first group that made it kind of legitimate for politicians to speak out. And since then, people like Juan Manuel Santos of Colombia, the president, so now acting presidents, are speaking out saying, look, this is a joke. We actually need to start considering regulation, consider decriminalization. So I think he's an incredibly important man for this whole subject.
And to the point of the United States, which we think of as really quite socially conservative in many ways, I assume, you know, you made this film far before November 6th when this vote came through. But how do you see the effect of what we'll see come into play over the next 2 years in Colorado and Washington over the whole of the United States and, you know, the Western world?
I find it absolutely astonishing that that happened. It's very, very exciting. There's a bit in the film, actually, where we talk about something similar happened in the 70s, which was decriminalization spread to 10 states with Jimmy Carter leading the way, kind of thing. And unfortunately, then Reagan came along and set up the kind of crusade, zero tolerance, Just Say No thing, and it all got stopped. But I'm hopeful that this time, actually, momentum is so much on reform's side that it will keep going. And for the world, I think it's very important, because America is the champion of the war on drugs, but now they're the first country in the world to have legal marijuana, the first legal marijuana ever. And so it completely undermines their position in the world.
And you just mentioned Jimmy Carter, and he's in the film, and Bill Clinton is also in the film. Both of them are now out of politics, but still sort of closely looked at as people whose opinions are very important. What sort of opinions do they offer for the state of the war on drugs today?
I mean, Jimmy Carter's been outspoken for a long time. When he was in power, he was saying we should decriminalize marijuana. Bill Clinton is more interesting, I think, because he actually admitted he opposed medical marijuana when he was president, and he admits that was a mistake. And he also admitted that opposing needle exchange was a mistake. So he is coming out and admitting mistakes, and he's saying we need to change. He had a brother who was addicted to cocaine, which he talks about. And he admits that, you know, drug addicts need to be treated as a health issue, not as a criminal one. That's the fundamental step that everyone needs to take.
Do you see the best way of this moving forward, I guess, with the powers that be, making it a financial argument in a sense and a security argument? Or is there more of a kind of ideological role that advocating liberalizing drugs can have?
I mean, yeah, there's the philosophical argument, you know, people should be allowed to do what they want as long as they're not hurting anyone else. But I think more important is the health argument, which is let's look at the users, let's treat them as patients, let's not treat them as criminals, because that's the way we help them. Locking an addict up doesn't help anyone and it costs more money than sending them to rehabilitation. So it's ridiculous. But then the more fundamental, I think the bigger question really for me is, fine, decriminalize drugs. That's the first step. That will sort out the user's problem. But as long as drugs are illegal, there's still going to be illegal markets, black markets, which are funding organized crime. So in the long run, it's the financial argument and the criminal argument that I think is most important. And we will have to face that at some point.
The debate surrounding the war on drugs, it's often filled with a lot of hypotheticals. But in your film, you look to Portugal and Holland as two examples of countries that have taken a very progressive approach to drug policy and drug liberalization. What sort of problems were these countries facing? How did they deal with them from a policy perspective? And what's the result been?
Portugal, the reason Portugal took the dramatic step it did, which was to decriminalize all drugs, which means that no one who's caught with the possession of any illegal drug goes to jail. It is not dealt as a criminal issue. They did that because they had terrible addiction problems and HIV was spreading through the drug using population. So they had a review of what they could do, and the board came up and said, we should decriminalize drugs, that will fix the problem. And they did it, and all the prohibitionists were like, this is going to be a drug paradise. It's going to be like a nightmare epidemic of addiction. It's all going to, like, the whole country's going to collapse. And now there's a huge amount of debate about whether it worked, whether it didn't. But, I mean, what you can't argue about is Portugal is not a disaster zone. Drugs among 14 to 26-year-olds, which is kind of the most important demographic, after 10 years, drug use has gone down for all drugs. And no one's going to prison, and the treatment is much better. So it has worked. And Holland, similarly, I mean, it's just marijuana, so they have coffee shops. And their drug use has plateaued, basically. That, essentially, both of these places show that your drug laws actually have very little correlation to the prevalence of drug use in a country. That's not actually what dictates whether people take drugs. It's the education, it's the culture. And so we need to work on that. You can stop arresting people. That doesn't work anyway. So that's what Holland and Portugal show, really.
Cosmo Fielding Mellon, director of Breaking the Taboo, thank you very much. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly.
Going to break for a song now. This is new from Sudanese-born US-raised Sin Cane with Running.
Thank you.
That was Sinn Cain with Runnin'. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly with me, Aisha Spears, and Barrett Austin. We'll be learning what it means to be British next.
Tully Kadar, a barista at Mecca Espresso in stunning Sydney, can't decide between the incredible warmth of the people and the outstanding beauty of the scenery when it comes to what makes life in Australia such a daily delight.
We have beautiful weather, a lovely culture, a unique sense of humour. Quality of life is just very high, and I'm very proud of the Aussie culture. I like our matter-of-factness. I feel like we have sort of a good balance between the outgoing, almost ostentatious American style and the very reserved British sensibility. I feel like we kind of land a healthy balance, and the culture's pretty cool.
There's nothing like Australia.
As 2012 draws to a close, Monocle has put together a selection of gifts that we'd like to find under the tree this year.
People of all ages turn to the teddy bear as the king of cuddly toys, and Shropshire's Merrythought is the firm to turn to. As the last remaining teddy manufacturer in the UK, its bears have become a sought-after collector's item. Opt for a classic Jackfield and an additional teddy bear picnic set, complete with a tartan blanket, miniature teacups and pots.
From portable coffee bean roasters to special edition parfum, you can find gift inspiration by watching our seasonal slideshow on monocle.com.
In a year that's seen the Olympics recharge the British Isles and made many of us dust off the notion that being a Brit is sometimes kind of all right, it means that the notion of Britishness is being embraced for the first time in a generation.
But it hasn't always been so. Famously apologetic, the Brits can often seem too caught up in a history that ranges from the colonial guilt to that plucky sporting underdog spirit.
And that conflict of interests hasn't escaped our next guest, Colin Brown, whose book Real Britannia takes a historical look at British culture to find out what being British means today. Monocle's Andrew Tuck and Steve Bloomfield met him earlier.
Colin Brown, welcome to the Monocle Weekly. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Now, your book looks at Britain's 10 proudest years, or in your opinion, what they are, or what many people say there are. Tell us the story behind why you decided to examine this.
David Cameron, the Prime Minister, made an enormous gaffe when he went to America in 2010. He was presumably trying to ingratiate himself with the Americans and said that in 1940, we were the minor partners to America who faced then the might of the Nazi regime of Hitler. And of course, he was completely wrong on loads of scores, but we were actually alone in 1940 and people were quick to point that out. He tried to compensate for that by saying, well, anyway, it was sorry about making the mistake, but 1940 was still the proudest year in his view. And I thought that was unexceptional. I would have said exactly the same. And then it started a national debate. There was a real controversy about which was our proudest year. And YouGov carried out a poll which showed the nation was completely split over what it thought was our proudest year. Women tended to vote in favour of years of social advance, such as the final year, 1928, when women ultimately got the vote on equal terms with men. Or 1948, when the NHS was created, men tended to go for military victories, such as 1415 Agincourt, or 1940, the Battle of Britain. And I thought, well, if the Prime Minister doesn't know his history, and I'm pretty vague about some of these dates myself, I'll investigate and see what it is. So I went at it like an investigative journalist, and I began to interrogate the past. And you can actually read it not just as a history book, but as a travel book, because it goes to these places, gets a sense of place, finds out what places are like today. And I'm telling you, there are loads of surprises. And if you think history is boring and it's mostly about dead people, you're completely wrong. Read this book, you see that history is alive and kicking and sometimes quite ugly.
Reading the book, I was struck by that there seems to be four or five books you think you've almost packed into there. There is a history book, And it's interesting, we'll unpack it a little bit in a moment, but even looking at 1940, there are so many asides about, you know, was actually Churchill more, you know, is stuck in an appeasement debate even when he got to power. And yeah, you know, so there's the political journalist skill brought to that as well. You even take a swipe at the Maritime Museum along the way. What did you want this in the book? Because although it's about kind of pride and what made Britain great, it sounds like you're building up a bit more of a picture of modern Britain by telling these stories of the past.
Well, it's very much an approach of an investigative journalist going back to the past. And there were some hairs on the back of the neck moments. For instance, I found some American academic papers challenging the idea that Queen Elizabeth I had ever used the words we attribute to her now for the Great Armada speech, in which she said, I have the body of a weak and feeble woman, but the stomach of a king, stomach and heart of a king. And I thought it would be interesting to track down an account of the speech. And I think I did so when I went to the British Library, asked them to turn up a particular document, and there it was, written out in scrawly longhand at the time, on parchment. And I think that that was written on the day she delivered it, in 1588. I was touching history. Moments like that are just fantastic. And there was another time when I was exploring why on earth did William of Orange, when he landed in Britain to carry out one of the little-known invasions of this country since 1066, why did he go all the way to Devon to land instead of Hull, which would have been just across the North Sea, a bit of a hop? And when I got there, I was asked, have you come to see the Orange Marches? And I said, well, what Orange Marches? And it turns out that every year, round about the 5th of November, the date when William of Orange landed, there are Orange lodges from all over Britain, Ireland and Liverpool. They descend on this little fishing port and march around the town. And when you see them, as I did, it just turns back the clock. You hear the drums, the fifes, the rattle of these drums, the big drum pounding out, and then they start singing the sash my father wore. It was a history coming alive, and it would not have been very much different when William of Orange marched around the town. Now, those same marches will be in the front line when David Cameron attempts to change the Act of Succession so that he would allow the heir to the throne to marry a Catholic for the first time in 300 years. Those same people will come out of the woodwork and start protesting. They may be a very small minority, but that's history and alive for you, if you like.
How important do you think it is that Britain gets to grips with its history? It's often discussed that we don't really do our own history that well. And certainly people on the right say, you know, rail about the fact that we don't tell our island story. Do you think that's fair, or do you think actually, you know, we don't do a bad old job of it?
I think you have to be careful about the way that you teach history. I think it has to have some context, but I shy away from the idea, the modern idea, which I was confronted with at the National Maritime Museum, where they've dropped teaching through the galleries about simply battles, and now they see everything in the context of particularly Atlantic trade. There's one enormous gallery there devoted to Atlantic trade and the passage of people, by which they mean slavery. And they're quite strong on slavery. The children would go to the National Maritime Museum, come away very knowledgeable about slavery, but they won't know much about Nelson's battles, for instance, because some of his campaigns are in the Mediterranean and they skirt over that. I went and asked one of the attendants, could she show me to the Armada Gallery, because I wanted to know how the English fleet had defeated the Spanish Armada. I can tell you it was because the ships were much more manoeuvrable. And I got a blank. The reason is there is no Armada Gallery there. There is no contrast and compare in our own National Maritime Museum for how we defeated the Dons in 1588. I think that's amazing.
Do you think that that was the last year, though, that there's something that really unites people? Because you do talk about the National Health Service being launched, and we saw that celebrated in the Olympics, but it doesn't quite bring people together in the same way. And you talk about the Falklands, but that's still a very divisive issue. You talk about the sinking of the Argentinian ship, the Belgrano. Do you think we just lack something that updates who we are? And the last point on that, we had a conference here, we had a drink session here for some foreign correspondents here in London, and one of the German correspondents from German TV said, "You're so stuck still in 1940, it's extraordinary." He said, "The thing I always smile to myself about is the fact that Prince Philip speaks fluent German, but you would never, ever hear him speak German in public for fear of upsetting the image you have of 1940.
Well, I think there's a lot of truth in the fact that some members of the establishment particularly are still locked in 1940. I think anybody under sort of 40 years of age thinks 1940 was a foreign country and certainly would not be locked into any of that. It's just that it is the fact that had we lost the Battle of Britain in 1940 and had we been invaded, we would have ceased to exist as an independent country. I go into the way that Churchill, quite remarkably, not only had to oppose those who were wanting to do a deal with Hitler before the war broke out, but the appeasers came back. After France had fallen in 1940, it was little known until recently when the cabinet records came out that the appeasers pushed him into a corner and got very close to forcing him either to resign or accept an agreement with Hitler through Italy, actually, acting as a go-between. It was largely through Churchill and the Labour members of the war cabinet that Britain held out against the deal. Now, it subsequently became clear that all males between the ages of 17 and 55 would have been transported to work camps in Europe if the Germans had invaded Britain. The appeasers seemed to think that their lives would go on merrily and they could join with Germany in attacking Russia because they saw the communists as being the main threat. And I think that some people still felt, even after the war, still feel today that we made a mistake in fighting Hitler and instead of which we should have attacked the communists. Well, the truth was far more brutal than they accepted. And one of the subtexts of what I've written about is the extent to which there's spin going on throughout the centuries. And one of the things that Churchill did, I was amazed to find out, was that he kept up the threat of an invasion long after he knew it had passed in order to keep the British public together.
Now, the passion with you just speak there, I just ask a small addendum. Do you think we lack about a certain amount of pride about what we've achieved then?
No, I don't think we lack pride. I think as a country, we are very proud. I think that you can dismiss 2012 as an aberration. 2012, I think, is an important year because it's shown us what we can do as a new nation. The immigration figures are showing that we now have nearly 4 million people, more than we had just 10 years ago. Now, I was born in 1950. The country has completely changed, completely transformed since 1950. There was hardly a black face in the village. There wasn't a black face in the village where I was born. I would have had to have gone to Liverpool, another 30 miles away, before I would have seen anybody with a different coloured skin. It's very different from that now. And there are people of my generation who seem to take this argument as if they could turn the clock back to 1950, never mind 1940. It was a golden age for them. They do not accept and will have to that we are a very new nation. But 2012 has shown us that the Union Jack should not just be claimed by the BNP. We should be quite proud. And so should the immigrants into Britain who've come in the last 10 years. Young people today have got absolutely no problem, it seems to me, with immigration. And they can teach something to their elders. And I think that 2012 has demonstrated that there is a coming together, that immigrants like Mo Farah can actually win, and we can all be out of our seats cheering for him because he's one of us. He accepts and embraces his Britishness.
Colin Brown, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you very much for joining us. The book is Real Britannia, Our 10 Proudest Years, The Glory and the Spin. Thank you very much for coming in.
That was Colin Brown speaking to Andrew Tuck and Steve Bloomfield earlier.
Up next, we'll be going around India by train.
Stephen Newland is a seaplane pilot on Queensland's magnificent coastline and is in no doubt that the colourful, dazzling, awe-inspiring Great Barrier Reef is the finest natural wonder in the world.
I'd have to say, especially around this area here, the water and the scenery is just incredible. The Great Barrier Reef just changes every day. It's never the same.
There's nothing like Australia.
Whether you're looking for gift ideas, clothing, or something for the home, we can help. Monocle has a selection of beautifully appointed shops in New York, London, Tokyo, Hong Kong, and our latest edition in College Street, Toronto. Scarves by Drake, wallets by Ettinger, and wine cups by Hakkisan are just a small selection of Monocle's collaborations with designers from around the world. Plus, if you've got any gaps in your collection of Monocle back issues, well, we can help with that too. So do pop in and say hello at any of our Monocle shops.
Last week, Andrew Tuck and Robert Bound had the pleasure of meeting UK-based Bhangra musician Kuljit Bamra to learn a little more about the music of India. This week, we're going to step further and take a train trip around India with the help of Monisha Rajesh.
Monisha's book, Around India in 80 Trains, handily does exactly what it says. She spent 4 months jumping trains and taking the scenic route around the nations, and she joins us now in the studio to tell us a few experiences from riding those trains. Monisha, a very warm welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Thank you very much.
First of all, I want to start by asking, how did this book come about?
Right, well, I was sitting at my very, very grey desk in London back in November 2009.
None of us are familiar with that.
No, especially not with how it is right now. It was very similar. And I started reading an article about how India's domestic airlines could now connect 80 cities. So I pulled up a map and I was quite taken by this because I'd lived in India very briefly as a kid. And when we were there, there were just two airlines and you could really not get that far. So I had a look at the map and then I could see underneath this incredible network, sort of like embroidery all the way around the country, and I realised that this was the railway system. And so suddenly, it was literally a space of a couple of seconds, I thought, oh, 80 planes sounds a bit too much, but how about doing around India in 80 trains? And it was that simple, actually.
And how did you start? How did you plan your route? Did you kind of, is there such a thing as a country pass and that you can just buy and jump on all the trains? How did you actually do this?
Yes, you can actually do that. I got an Indrail pass from the Indian Railways representative in the UK in Wembley, and it was an absolute golden ticket to the trains because in India, the sales open 120 days in advance, which is just insane for anyone doing any kind of spontaneous trip. And so you would just not be able to do what I did if you just went there and tried to get on. So I got the pass and it was a 90-day pass, which cost me about £350. So because I'd prepaid everything, I could just make reservations as I got there.
And in the book, you describe an amazingly diverse range of trains that you took while in India.
Yes.
Tell us about some of the different trains that you boarded.
Well, I think the trains that most people seem to be quite familiar with are either the Mumbai commuter trains, where you get this incredible vision of people jammed into the doorways and piled on top of the roofs. But in actual fact, you can't get on the roofs anymore because they're all quite electrified. but you still see people crammed in the doorways. But I didn't want people to just have that notion of India. And so I made sure that I covered a couple of the luxury trains, which is sort of, again, something you see on TV a lot. But I also did a lot of the commuter trains and the general passenger trains. I did the hill station railways. And I also did a hospital on wheels called the Lifeline Express, which I found out at the very last minute that was apparently the world's first hospital train. It's been going for 20 years. and yet almost no one in India has heard of it.
How does that work? So they're picking up people in rural communities, or how does that?
No, the way it's set up by an NGO called Impact India, and it started 20 years ago, and they basically deem certain areas in India worthy of healthcare, and it's mainly for rural people who can't actually get access to hospitals very easily. So once they've worked out how badly these people need attention, the train goes out to that area and actually parks there for about 5 weeks for each project, and they invite people on board, and it's sort of divided up, but on a week-to-week basis. So the first week is they'll do operations on children who've had polio. Then they have eye surgeons come in to do cataracts the next week. Then they have ENT surgery. And they've now started sort of broadening it so they can offer counselling for parents of kids with epilepsy to teach them that they're not possessed and it's not anything like that. It's actually treatable. So I spent about 10 days on the train just watching this incredible life-changing surgery that, you know, would normally have them suffering throughout life. And it's something that we have fixed immediately, like cleft lips are done as soon as you're born. And there people will live to 70 with a cleft palate. And it was quite amazing for me. I think that train was the one that really made me see how valuable the railways is to people over there. And we just take that for granted completely.
I think that I've only actually taken one train in India, and it was a Mumbai commuter service, and it was between Mumbai and Surat.
Right.
And so I decided to ride two different carriages, one where I was kind of crammed in with chickens, and the other one, which was the nicest way that you could ride. And what I found intriguing is it's so kind of organic the way it works. You haven't got a train conductor who's got, there's not a food cart. You sit there every time you pull into a station, from what I remember, someone comes on with some sort of food. It feels very much part of Indian daily life. And how is that different from how we see it in many other countries?
Well, in fact, I was thinking about where else I could have written my book, and I realised that there probably wasn't any other country that would have lent itself to this in the same way, because it really is like a microcosm of society over there. You can go from one end of the train where you have first-class cabins with, you know, lovely cutlery and nice diningware and ambassadors and politicians travelling, right down to 37 carriages the other end, and you've got people crammed into, you know, the roof racks and luggage compartments, and 20 people in a compartment of 10. And I think that's what made the stories come to life, because you don't have to go very far to find them. They're there. They're absolutely in front of you all the time. And it's not something you see here. I mean, we don't speak to each other.
Yeah.
You can spend 2 hours on a train sitting in a table with someone and you barely make eye contact. And that was something that really struck me when I came back, as to how sort of self-contained and actually quite insular we all are. Yeah.
And let's talk a little bit about some of the people that you met along the way. There's an amazing cast of characters described in the book. Who are some of the more interesting ones?
I met one of the ambassadors I met, who I didn't realise was an ambassador till the very end of the trip. He was just very sort of dressed in German street splendour, and I remember thinking, there's something about you I can't quite put my finger on, but he knew everything about the trains. And after 4 hours, when we were just getting off in Delhi, he handed me his card, and it was Ambassador to The Hague, and I thought, right, that's why you're so knowledgeable. But he gave me these fantastic routes that I hadn't even considered. And equally, I met a kid who sort of grew up next to a railway line, and his parents used to work in the railway, so he moved around a lot. And he actually sort of taught me how to make my bed properly, even after 62 train journeys. I didn't know how to do it. And he said, I'm appalled that, you know, it's taken you this long. And he taught me how to do it. And he taught me what the numbers on the outside of the trains meant, which I just assumed was sort of for factories. But they're always 5 digits. So if it's 88321, it means it was built in 1988. It was the 321st train carriage to be built that year. So you can work out which are the best ones to get on. So if it says, you know, 08, you'd be much better off getting on that carriage for nicer seats and interiors and things than one that says 87, because it's that much older and rickety. And I really wished I had that little gem in my knowledge before I actually did all the journeys. But I would keep getting this sort of information from people.
Do you know how many miles you travelled on the trains?
I did 40,000 kilometres, which is the circumference of the Earth, which wasn't planned. I just sat with a spreadsheet when I came back home, and I listed every train, every number, and I actually sat with a calculator and worked it out, and it was about 39,600 or something. And then I realised it was the same distance, which was quite insane.
How do you think this, you know, the catalyst for you going there was seeing all these new airlines coming up in India. Mm. How do you see the railways changing over the next couple of decades as possibly air travel may or may not take hold there?
Well, I think, air travel is not doing very well right now over there. And I think people are becoming more aware of how much they can actually get out of their trains, because they're not treated very well. That's the one sad thing. They're treated badly. There's rubbish everywhere. They're very sort of badly maintained. And I think In fact, the one railway minister who was fired earlier this year was trying to increase the fares ever so slightly just to sort of generate some revenue because they've been in debt for years. And he was fired for it, saying that he was exploiting the poor. And the irony is the poor actually tend not to pay for tickets because they jump on and jump off before people can come and check. But I think that, now they've started to actually implement a lot more. And you get much nicer classes. You get speed trains that they've started introducing. And I think people are going back on them. And I think that's really important because they cater to everybody. You can get a ticket for 10 rupees in one end of it and then, you know, for 2,000 at the other end. So everyone's covered.
I was just looking at your book and I see a quote where you say, India is the only place that you feel a foreigner.
Yeah.
What exactly do you mean by that?
Well, I think it's a problem I've actually had recently with reviews as well, that Indians on the whole don't like second-generation Indians writing about them because they feel they're very protective about their country and they don't like to be told anything that isn't sort of very sort of flattering. And the minute they hear an Indian name and then immediately see that you're not Indian born, they get very upset about it. And they have this phrase, which is NRI, which means non-resident Indian, which I hate. It just annoys me because, in fact, I'm not a non-resident Indian. I'm a British citizen. I have a British passport. And I would normally think of someone like Lakshmi Mittal being a non-resident Indian. Mm. But they call you that. You're always called NRIs and called, you know, Firangis and Goras, which is quite derogatory, actually. Mm. And I did. I do always find that when I go over there, you're immediately put into this typecast set. And that was something I wanted to actually sort of try and get rid of a little bit by showing that, I would obviously see India as a Westerner, but at the same time could still have a bit more insight by being Indian and being able to sort of meld the two.
Finally, do you think you'll ever get on a train in India again, or are you?
I've done it a lot.
Have you?
I've actually been back. I've been back a few times since, and I've actually been on the trains quite a bit. I find them quite addictive.
That's good.
Manisha, thank you very much for joining us here on the Monocle Weekly.
Thank you.
Now, Christmas is past, and we're looking forward to New Year's Eve. But in the city of Gävle, on Sweden's east coast, there's been an event hotting up that's somewhere in between.
Each year in December, Gävle is famous for constructing an enormous goat made from straw in the city centre. What follows is an apparently good-natured struggle between would-be arsonists and the townsfolk, who try to keep said goat from being set on fire. It sounds bizarre. And we have Monocle Stockholm correspondent Elna Nikanen Andersson on the line now to try and explain a little more about it. Elna, this is a very strange tradition. How did it start?
Well, it all started in 1966 when a local businessman came up with the idea of making this giant goat. And his idea was to attract customers to local shops and restaurants and so on with this enormous goat. But just a couple of weeks later, somebody burned it down. And after that, they've rebuilt it each year, and almost each year it's also been burnt.
Oh, no, I've just pulled up an image of the goat on Google, and it seems that in nearly every image the goat is in fact burning. But when it's not burning, what does it look like?
Well, it's pretty impressive. It's huge, as I say, and it's, if you know these small miniature goats that we, at least in Sweden, you hang them as decorations on Christmas trees and you have them around the tree and so on. It's just a huge version of that.
Why a goat? Is there any kind of reference to the region with a goat? Why did he build a goat?
Mm. Well, goat is a traditional decoration that we use here that has to do with Christmas. And I'm not an expert on this, but I suspect it has something to do with, you know, Bible and, you know, baby Jesus and the animals in the herd and so on.
I'm kind of into that. The idea of the nativity is now represented by burning a straw goat. And the weirdest thing is, if I'm correct, that burning the goat is actually illegal.
Yeah, absolutely. It's vandalism, so it's punishable, and they try and find the people who do it. So even this year, the police has initiated an investigation to try and find the perpetrator.
And just looking at the response from townspeople there, what's the response like? I mean, do you think people are sort of staunchly looking forward to casting out would-be arsonists, or do you think perhaps people enjoy seeing a burning goat in the middle of Gävle?
Mm. Well, it's kind of 50-50. I mean, you kind of know that each year it's going to burn, and possibly, most probably, they're not going to find anybody. But on the other hand, people hope that it would make it at least past Christmas and maybe New Year's and so on, so that it would be there for a while. And not least the people who pay for it, which is this local merchants association. And because it's also good PR for the town to have the goat there, and they'd like to see it there at least for a month or so.
Anna, it seems a really weird situation, because it's good PR because we know that this goat is going to get burned. It's a strange thing for these local townspeople and local businesses to pay for this goat knowing that it's going to get burned. And, you know, Sweden's an incredibly developed country that manages to protect its own, you know, treasury and I'm sure all sorts of other things that they can defend. Why is it so hard to prevent a straw goat from being burned?
Yeah, maybe they don't take it as seriously. I mean, they've tried, they have web cameras there, and they've tried to treat the straws with this special flame retardant, but it hasn't helped. And I mean, I guess if they really, really wanted to, they could invest a lot of money in it, have guards there 24/7 or whatever. But on the other hand, I guess they're thinking, well, it's gotta burn as well, because that's the whole point with the goat.
And do you have any sort of amazing past anecdotes? I was reading something earlier, and it seems in 2005 there were a number of people who dressed as Father Christmas and went around as arsonists and ended up burning it down. But what are some of the stories in the past couple of years surrounding the burning of the goat?
Well, it's always, I guess, one of the most spectacular ones was one year when somebody drove their car right into the goat. And otherwise, it's usually people that come when it's dark and sort of just try and do it without any special effects. But yeah, as you say, there's been a few stranger things that happen.
Monocle's Stockholm correspondent Elna Nikanen Anderson, thank you very much. That's nearly all for edition 182 of the Monocle Weekly. Tomorrow evening is New Year's Eve. Barrett Austin, are you heading back to the US? What are your plans?
I'm still making up my mind. There's for a couple of weeks now, I've been toying with the idea of going to Mexico. I'm afraid it may be a little bit too late, but I've still just today been looking at plane tickets for a flying into Cancun and maybe a quick drive down to Tulum for a couple of days.
We mentioned your spring break antics, possibly. Cancun is pretty much the home of spring break, no?
Well, the fact that we've been discussing spring break in America has done much to sort of reignite the flame for me wanting to go to Mexico. I had plenty of friends through the years who went to Mexico for spring break. It always sounded pretty fun, and I don't think it's too late to maybe fit in a quick trip down there before the end of the year.
I think that's a good idea. I'm going to be here in London and flying back to New York on the 1st. So I'm not sure that if I'm flying on the 1st, I'm not really sure it's the best idea to have a big New Year's Eve. And what are you looking forward to in January in New York?
Well, you and I will be traveling to Italy. We'll be in Florence and Milan, sort of taking a look at fashion. So that's one thing that I'm looking forward to just, I guess, right around a week from now.
It will be Men's Week, yeah, indeed. So the men's shows will commence on around the 7th in Florence and then Milan, and then we'll be in Paris as well. And then finally we get to go back to our beloved New York. But that's all. And I hope that everyone has enjoyed our little sampling of everything from drugs to goats, which I never thought I would ever have to say. Today's show was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Pilar Lopez, and our studio manager was Jack Phillips with one L. It is Jack Phillips with one L. Rob Bound and Andrew Tuck will be back next week to relive the best moments of the year here on The Weekly. But for now, it's goodbye from me, Aisha Spears.
And from me, Barrett Austin. Goodbye.